The Guardian.
Do I need to explain that I've soaked each of these with their appropriate salts?
I think you need to.
Okay, so we've soaked each of these letters with flammable liquid, with some methanol and their appropriate salt. So the cesium here contains cesium salts.
What we're hearing now is Dr. Peter Wuthers and the combined BBC and Royal Institution technical teams running through the very elaborate preparations for this year's Christmas lectures. Titled The Modern Alchemist, the lecturer, Peter Wuthers, is from the Chemistry Department at the University of Cambridge. He's also a fellow of the Royal Society of Chemistry. Peter has chosen to focus his lectures on our modern understanding of the four classical elements: fire, water, earth, and air. I'm Alok Jha, and welcome to Science Weekly. This show is our annual programme dedicated to the historic Christmas lectures, which began in 1825 as an attempt by Michael Faraday to bring science to young people. They've run every year since, except during the Second World War, and lecturers have included David Attenborough, Richard Dawkins, and Dame Nancy Rothwell. Today we're getting a peek at the 2012 lectures from the latest addition to this pantheon of greats, Peter Wuthers. Peter, very exciting to have you here on the podcast. Now, tell me why chemistry for the lectures this year? Because, you know, chemistry is, let's be honest, not the most fascinating science.
It is the most fascinating science. I mean, there's no doubt there. I'm actually, when I found out that I was going to be giving these lectures, I mean, obviously I was very pleased that I was going to be giving these lectures, but actually I was really pleased that chemistry is going to be, you know, the theme.
Because I was being facetious just then, but go on.
Give
us your sort of two minutes.
No, it's because, as I say, I mean, so I think there hasn't been quite a lot of chemistry, you know, for quite some time now. And yet, you know, the first lecture that Michael Faraday gave was just titled Chemistry. And I think this is what, you know, they're so exciting, the demonstrations that you can do in chemistry, I think more so than many of the other sciences. And I think, you know, people do remember these really spectacular demonstrations. So I think that's one of the fun things about this.
I mean, chemistry does have a bit of it's one of those sciences that still hasn't been dragged into the sort of cool age of things with his Large Hadron Collider or Big Bang experiments and things. But this is hopefully you're going to do with these lectures. So tell me a little bit about the structure of the lectures. There's going to be three of them. What is each one going to cover?
So the underlying theme are the elements, but we've sort of taken an approach to, you know, sort of a nod back to the Greek idea of the elements. So this is air, water, earth and fire. Now, sadly, of course, there are only three lectures. Well, I say sadly, but having just been through them all, maybe four would be a bit too much. But so there's we're doing covering the elements that you'd find in air, the elements that you'd find in water. So not only just hydrogen, oxygen there, but also salts dissolved, and then things that you can extract from the earth. And so fire was a bit different anyway, isn't it? It's an imponderable, but there's going to be lots of fire in all of the lectures.
Okay, so fire is a theme in all of them.
There's certainly a lot of fire, yes.
And how do you sort of balance with things like the history and what the Royal Institution is most famous for, explosions and demonstrations?
Well, I mean, this is where chemistry really comes into its own. That sometimes you talk about the Large Hadron Collider and so on. I mean, it's all very exciting, but actually, it's sort of, you know, stunning to look at this big piece of equipment. You think, oh, that's very exciting. And then what do you do with it? But chemistry, you can actually see these reactions in progress. You can see, you know, changes taking place. And this is why I think it's, you know, really quite stunning.
Flames, bangs, all these sorts of things. Let's go one by one through the lectures. And the air. When did we discover that the air was something rather than nothing?
People were beginning to realise that the air was something when the air pump was invented. So as soon as you could remove the air, then it sort of, you know, people began to pay particular attention to it and its role. But the composition of the air is something rather different. And so, I mean, as I say, the idea that the Greeks, you know, thought that there was air was an element. Well, this prevailed until the 18th century, really, when in the 17th century, when Van Helmont began to prepare different gases and study these. He invented the word gas. Then Priestley came along later with oxygen, and Joseph Black before him with carbon dioxide and so on. But the composition, you know, took a while to work out.
And this is an interesting thing. It's 17th century onwards, people started working out that the air was a mixture of different things.
Not really in the 17th, in the sort of 18th began to appreciate the
different
components.
Then there was all these different elements in there. Yeah. Some of them burned, some of them were required for burning.
Although the idea of an element still wasn't sorted out at that point. Yes.
But I mean, this is really the birth of chemistry, isn't it?
Absolutely,
in that time. Yes. And just before then, people like Henry Cavendish and Joseph Priestley, as you mentioned. And then a character comes along, Antoine Lavoisier, tax inspector. Tell us about his importance in the history of your subject.
Well, I think he plays a key role because... I mean, he obviously was the first person to really fully explain what was happening during combustion. And this was a real problem because people didn't know what happened when something burnt. I mean, the sort of the ancient idea of the Greeks was that, you know, it was changing and something was a block of wood would be composed of these four elements. And when it was burning, it was just changing into different forms of those. But there was the phlogiston idea that when things burnt, because they contained this flammable principle, and it makes a lot of sense. So you can see that something's coming out when a block of wood burns. But there were problems when things like metals burn in air because they get heavier. Now, how do you explain that if it's because the metal contains this phlogiston and it's meant to be losing this as it's burning and yet it becomes heavier? So this was a real problem. But Lavoisier was the first person to fully understand the role of oxygen and say that there's something in the air that's actually combining with the metals and increasing their weight. And he made very careful measurements. And so, you know, he really was, as I say, first understood this. And he invented the term oxygen, for instance. It had a bit of an error there, because the word comes from acid form. He thought that oxygen was the principle of acidity, so he didn't get everything right. But and there's good reasons for saying
but
that.
But he also named hydrogen, didn't he, as well?
He also named hydrogen, yes. Yeah. I always think it's rather curious, actually, because you could actually swap the two words over, because hydrogen means acid former, and so it means water former, and of course it is the principle of acidity, whereas oxygen means acid former, but it is also in water. So you could easily just swap the two words over, and that'll make much more sense.
It's more confusing for water people surely. But so Lavoisier also did something important. I mean, as well as all these experiments which are showing, which, by the way, let's just pause on this for a second, are incredible experiments to do when you don't know that this stuff around you is something and is composed of lots of things, the careful measurements you need. When it's very easy for us to think about this stuff now because we know it, but back then no one knew this stuff, and there wasn't even a method of describing this stuff between people. There was no chemistry at the time.
Well, I mean, Lavoisier's real insight was not the new experiments. I mean, many of the experiments had been carried out just before, you know, he was doing them, but he made very careful measurements, and that was the key thing, that he could say, well, you know, this amount of substance is missing from the air now, and the mercury that has reacted with this, you know, has gained that same amount. So this was his real skill, actually, sort of, you know, balancing the books. But one of the other key things that Lavoisier did, though, and this is why I think he's really the father of modern chemistry, is because he, together with a group of other colleagues, started the nomenclature for chemistry. So this was, you know, prior to this time, there are all sorts of different names that people were using for substances. So you have words like, you know, butter of antimony, which describes its appearance. Lavoisier then initiated a reform of nomenclature where the names actually were reflecting the composition. And as soon as people were then thinking, well, what is this stuff actually made of? And the name reflects what it's made of. Then, of course, that chemical formulae naturally followed on from that, and the composition and so on. So I think that, you know, really was the birth of modern chemistry.
And without that sort of nomenclature, you can't really discuss things in scientific papers and move forward. I mean, that's kind of his major contribution.
Well, I mean, it's a step on from nomenclature in that he got people thinking about the composition. I mean, and the real thing of chemistry is of course, the chemical formulae. And this is what, you know, a lot of people get tied up with and think it's all sort of incomprehensible gibberish. But, you know, it does make a lot of sense.
So let's move on to water then. So what is it about water that makes it special and deserving of an entire hour of discussion?
Well, I mean, it's pretty important to us since we're mainly composed of water. But it's also, I say, it was going back to the Greek idea of their elements. But we can explore the components of water in terms of the hydrogen oxygen, the reaction there, how hydrogen, you know, is a very attractive fuel for the future, you know, since it burns very cleanly and the byproduct is just water and so on. But then we're also looking at, well, how can we generate our hydrogen? At the moment, most of the hydrogen that's used actually comes from natural gas in the first place, and a byproduct of that is still carbon dioxide during that process. Now, of course, I mean, that can be managed and not necessarily released, but splitting up water would be a very attractive way to make hydrogen if that were possible. Now, of course, hydroelectric plants provide one means to do that, but there is also a lot of research all around the world at the moment trying to find catalysts that could use energy from the sun to split up the water into hydrogen and oxygen.
Which
and
is what plants do.
Which is what plants do, although they're sort of hydrogen, they don't, they sort of use their hydrogen as they go in along. But yes, they're spitting out the oxygen, which is very nice. But the catalysts would actually provide us with hydrogen fuel and oxygen. So that's really very, very attractive indeed.
And going back to Lavoisier, sorry to do this, but he was also instrumental in working out the formula of water, wasn't it?
Well, he was one of the ones, yes. Yeah, I mean, there was also James Watt and Cavendish.
That's
and so
right.
on. So,
there's a bit of an argument about who actually came up with the formula, isn't there?
Well, the formula is another issue, actually. I mean, but just the composition, I mean, that's the key thing, that it is hydrogen combined with oxygen. So there are a number of people that sort of lay different claims to this. But I think Cavendish, I put my money on Cavendish.
You would. You're a Western chemist. Of course you would. Of course you would. So water, of course, you mentioned earlier, it's full of things. I mean, what you very rarely find pure water on the earth. It's got something dissolved in it, in our bodies. It's incredibly important in all of our biochemical reactions and things. And for life to function. In fact, for life to start, even. What makes it so special in that way?
Again, this is some of the unique properties of this substance. I mean, so we're not actually spending the whole lecture just looking at water. We are looking at the components. But I have given whole lectures just on water because it is such an amazing substance. I mean, it's such a small molecule. And, this is one of the classic things from the sort of, school classes that you learn that it's so small. And yet it's a liquid. Well, why is it a liquid? What keeps these molecules together? These small molecules should normally be gases. And then you've got the hydrogen bonding sort of, holding the water molecules together as water or as maybe as ice and so on. So that's quite a fun thing, and exploring the nature of those bonds and why water expands as it freezes. This huge expansion when it goes from liquid to the gas, which of course has driven the Industrial Revolution and still is used to generate most of our electricity from the turbines and so on. So it's an absolutely fascinating substance.
Move on to Earth finally, which is basically everything else. You've done air, you've done water. Earth is everything. Are we talking minerals here? Are we talking resources?
Yes. I mean, so I wanted to sort of look at two different sides to this. I mean, on the one hand, there are, what is the Earth mainly made up and why?
Earth mainly made up of?
Well, I mean, so different oxide minerals. I mean, so, hematite, aluminium oxides, silicon
oxygen,
dioxide.
Lots of oxygen in there.
Exactly, lots of oxygen. And this is a key thing as well. I mean, oxygen actually is one of the themes throughout the whole lecture series in the sense that, the first one is obviously a component of the air, and the second it's a component of water. But in the third, most minerals are made up, of elements combined with oxygen. So it's how we can extract things from there and how, technology changed over time. And, we gradually developed the ability to extract these different elements. So, for instance, copper is relatively easy to extract from its ores. I mean, first of all, you roast your copper carbonate, for instance, if it's malachite or whatever, you get your copper oxide. And that's quite easy to remove the oxygen just, with carbon. But iron is much harder to extract. So the Iron Age follows the Bronze Age. But then there are sort of, more recent elements that are extracted from the earth. One of the most notable ones, of course, being silicon. And now we're using this in our silicon age, which is quite exciting. But that was, of course, it's rather nice, I always think, that, now we're using silicon. But of course, that was the first substance that mankind made use of, sort of flints, which are just silicon oxides. But they had no idea that there was, two elements trapped in there. And it took thousands of years before they actually were able to separate them.
That's interesting, isn't it? The harder it takes, the harder it is to isolate an element. That gives you your timeline of various civilizations. So the way these things, the chemistry of the way that our crust is made, actually determines human civilization to some extent.
Yeah, I mean it's how dispersed it is. Can you find these things lying around? I mean, so gold. I mean, it's very rare. But of course, you just find it, because when you do notice it, it's quite a stunning substance. But there are other elements that are equally as rare, but they're much harder to extract, and you don't find them lying around. So there is a difference there, and that's this is what gold was known since ancient times. But uranium wasn't discovered until the 18th century. So
there's a book there about the chemistry of civilizations, isn't there?
Well, it's funny you should say that. Yes.
is that next on your list?
Well, yes, I do have a book that's near completion, but it's.
We'll talk about that maybe when you've done it then. Chemistry is noted, if for nothing else, in people's minds who don't know anything about it, for colourful flames, big explosions. The RI is noted for those things too. I can't imagine you've not got these dotted throughout these lectures, more so than any of the lectures recently.
I think, yeah, I'm very pleased with the demonstrations we've got, but I must
give us a bit of a highlight.
Well, I mean, I must say that they've caused some problems for the Royal Institution.
Absolutely,
you wouldn't believe it. I mean, one of the destroyed a bit of it. I think the worst one was in the air lecture. I wanted to show how we can get oxygen and nitrogen to combine. And one way this can happen is during a lightning storm. In fact, this was actually the first way that nitrogen and oxygen were made to combine. This was just using an electrical discharge. In fact, nitrogen, the word itself, comes from this ability to form nitre, which is potassium nitrate. And this was brought about by sparking mixtures of nitrogen and oxygen together and then dissolving the gases, which are nitrogen dioxide, in alkali. And then you get a component of gunpowder. So this is nitrogen means nitre forming from this. So I wanted to show this though in the lectures themselves. But so we brought a friend of mine from school who is part of his business is to create these magnificent scientific works of art. So this is Colin Dancer. As I say, we were at school together. He built one of these Tesla coils for me, and it generated 1,000,000 volts. But I don't think the RI electronics seemed to like this. So first of all, when we were testing it, the sort of fire alarm went off, and then we thought, Well, that can't be us because it's in the basement. The next time we tested it, the fire alarm went off again in the basement, but not just the fire alarm. It was sort of the electrics in the whole lecture theatre. The lights kept sort of flashing on and off, and then it was controlling people's mobile phones and so on. And it was just, the whole thing was just...
Yeah, did it work in the end?
Oh, of course it worked. It's fantastic, but I don't think the RI are too pleased because they had to replace a few components in their theatre.
I also heard rumours about an explosion on the roof.
We've had a few little things on
what
the roof.
That
was quite fun. No, well, that was one of the sort of our trailers that we were developing for the RI channel. We had sort of one big demonstration for each of the air, water and earth lectures. So the one on the roof was actually, it was heating up some oil. And of course, everyone knows what happens if you heat up oil, it can catch fire. But what people really should be aware of, if you do have an oil fire at home, like in a chip pan, you should never add water to it. And so this is what we were demonstrating. What happens if you add a tiny amount of water to a tiny amount of burning oil? But I mean, the flames for this were about 12 foot high, which is quite exciting. So we developed all the apparatus to do this in a safe, controlled manner. But it really looked quite spectacular, I must say.
Okay, well, I'm sure. I hope that the TV lectures do justice to some of this stuff, because I mean, I've been in that lecture theatre many times, and it's always great to see experiments there. And I hope that it translates, because that's I think going to make people gasp if it does work. I hope. You've done hundreds of these lectures before, and you're a teacher at University of Cambridge, so you know the teaching part of it, the demonstration part of it, can't be new to you. But so, what's so knackering about them?
Actually, it's much easier to do some of these demonstrations in a university environment. I mean, the RI, I mean, it's such a busy place. There are sort of all sorts of scientists coming and going, and they're sort of filming all sorts of things all the time. It's very difficult to get full rehearsals with all the demonstrations and also all the backup spares and things. So, you know, if I melt a retort stand and clamp, they say, oh, you know, that's our retort stand and clamp, and they haven't got sort of, you know, hundreds of them just lying around. So there are, you know, technical problems there that, it's easier in a chemistry laboratory, in a university laboratory, than something that's sort of geared up to other areas of science as well. So that's one of the issues, that just the sort of the support there. It sort of posed new problems for the RI, I think.
Lots of midnight working, was it?
There was, actually,
lots
yes.
18-hour days and
Well,
things.
But I mean, the Tesla coil was one nightmare. I mean, the fact that it just took over most of the RI electronics in the building. But then there was also the half-kilometre pipe. That was that took quite a while to try and sort of rig up. But again, I mean, the explosions through that, I mean, look absolutely brilliant.
I'm going to ask you what you're doing with a half-kilometre pipe. You will have to see. Which lecture is that in?
That's in the second lecture, that
okay,
one.
Okay, well, something to watch out for.
Yep.
Can I ask you about what got you into chemistry in the first place? The way you describe everything sounds incredibly alive with detail, and there's stuff you can hold and see, and you know, some of it might be dangerous, but if you're careful, this is a wonderful thing to do. I mean, it's different to say theoretical cosmology, for example, or you know, for example, synthetic biology, which is wet and icky, but those things seem much more exciting than chemistry. Why is it?
No, they're not. They're not more exciting than chemistry.
To those of us on the outside, that's completely wrong.
I mean, chemistry, as I say, is the most exciting
science. Tell me what you got into it.
I mean, you can actually do these reactions in front of you. What are you going to do when you do get sort of, you know, home biology kits? And what are you going to do there? Oh, sort of, you know, this is DNA. Well, all it does is look like slime. It could be anything. But you know, you can have your chemistry set. You can have samples of the elements. You can see how these combine. You can carry out reactions. I mean, that's you know, real science.
Am I to assume that there has to be a yes to this? You had many chemistry sets as a child.
Oh, of course I did, yes. No, I mean, so I don't know what it was about chemistry, but I was absolutely hooked on this from about the age of 8. And I mean, so as soon as I got into my secondary school, they just sort of realised that, well, you know, they couldn't keep up with my sort of thirst for the subject. And in the end, they just said, well, you know, there's no point coming to these classes, you know, go and sort of do your own thing in a way, which was very nice. But so I did work my way through chemistry sets, and then I got a job working for a laboratory suppliers, and they used to pay me in chemicals and equipment. I mean, I had a stunning lab
at home.
They paid
you in chemicals?
Absolutely. I mean, so I had...
Is that legal?
Well, it probably was at the time. But I had sort of, you know, centrifuges, Bunsen burners, balances, all sorts of things. And, you know, well, I think people were probably quite worried if they found out the sort of chemicals I had at the time. But, you know, I was absolutely hooked on this subject from that point. And it has never gone. I mean, I have a very strong interest in the history of chemistry as well. That's because I used to go to secondhand bookshops and pick up sort of, you know, textbooks of chemistry. But then I just sort of found things that got earlier and earlier. And it's just, you know, it's all sort of, you know, woven together. And I just sort of keep thinking about new possibilities, new ways of showing things and so on.
I mean, I think you convinced me, and I'm fairly certain that everyone listening to this will be convinced too. But step outside that for a second. Let's just go into this. Why is it a Cinderella science in some ways? When we spoke last time, you did say that you wanted this to become something that flowers in people's imaginations a bit. I mean, why do you think that chemistry does get a bit of a bad rap?
Well, I think part of it is because people are put off chemistry from school. I think unless you really grasp it, you know, at the sort of, you know, the earliest stages with chemical formulae and so on, unless you really understand what that's all about, from that point on, you can just be switched off from the subject. You think, oh, you know, I don't really follow all this. And so I think it's sort of, you know, it all goes back to sort of your first introduction to the subject, how it's taught, and, you know, are you doing the experiments
for
yourselves?
But there's so much potential for excitement, as you described.
Oh, there is, absolutely.
So are chemistry lessons at school just not getting that across somehow?
I think there are issues. I mean, sometimes the teachers aren't necessarily specialists in that subject, and so maybe they don't feel as comfortable doing some of the experiments. But I know the kids, you know, absolutely love doing, you know, even relatively simple chemistry experiments. I mean, and there are sort of ways that they can sort of do these safely. I mean, the Royal Society of Chemistry spent a lot of effort trying to work out, you know, methods of getting these into the classroom so that students really are doing these practicals.
I mean, are we also slightly put off chemistry because of the word chemicals? People seem to think that the word chemicals means something bad.
But that's a misunderstanding. Yeah. I mean, one of the demonstrations lectures that I give at Cambridge in the Science Festival is called Free Range Chemistry. And so I didn't want to call it sort of organic chemistry or anything like that. So I wanted to emphasize that this is just using chemicals from nature. So this is things that you can find lying around, and you can still do explosions and things with them. But, you know, ultimately, our whole world is made up of, you know, the elements combined together to give us molecules, compounds, and so on. You know, we are chemicals. When you make a cup of tea, you are doing chemistry. You are extracting things that you want from things that you don't want. I mean, you don't want a mouthful of tea leaves. So you've done some chemistry. You've made a hot solution, you've filtered it, and you've extracted what you want. That is what the chemist does.
Cooking is chemistry.
Indeed. But I mean, so I think making a cup of tea is the clearest thing. So the chemist is trying to separate out those ingredients, perhaps, that they want from those that, you know, they don't want. And so, you know, a lot of drug production is just trying to get very pure samples of active ingredients, as opposed to maybe some of the more traditional natural medicines where, well, actually you have no idea what's in there. Of course, there's, you know, they may well work and they may well be, you know, the key ingredient, but it would be better in many ways to actually know what the key ingredient is and to be able to isolate that and take that, you know, maybe with other things if it's needed or whatever, but at least you know what you're taking.
And in any case, that has chemicals anyway, because everything is chemicals.
Everything is chemicals,
it's not,
yes.
This shouldn't be a bad word. Does it annoy you, though, that you know, that there's all this publicity and usually around the New Year's, there's going to be all sorts of detox things saying, get all the chemicals out of your body. I mean, this is a chemical-free skin peel or something. Does that annoy you, or do you just...
It does annoy me. I mean, there is one sort of food chain that says there are no obscure chemicals in our food. I thought, well, how ridiculous. I mean, you know, if you look at a toasted pine nut, you'd have no idea of the obscure chemicals that are in there. I mean, in this lecture that I give on the free-range chemistry, I mean, I make the point that in a cup of coffee, over 2,000 different compounds have been identified in that cup of coffee. So, and there are thousands of others that we haven't yet identified. So it's, you know, yes, they're obscure, and, you know, get over it, really. I mean, this is life. I mean, you know, we are just big bag of chemicals.
What
really.
Do you want people to take away from the lectures then? After on the 28th of December, which is the last lecture, people and the credits are rolling. What do you want people to take away as they digest their Christmas dinners?
I'd like them to go away with a better understanding of the subject, because that would give them an understanding of the world around them. Because I mean, this is why I love chemistry, because it is how we interact with our world. I mean, you know, I can look at this glass and I know what it's made of. I can understand its composition. I can, you know, look at the water inside it and understand, you know, how it's bonded together and so on. And so, you know, the air around us. And this is the thing. It's just looking at the world in a slightly different way with a better understanding. And I think that's a lovely thing. So yes, if people can go away with a better understanding of their world, I think that'll be great. And also, if they can see, you know, what a fun subject this is.
You want another generation of young people doing chemistry. This is always the lecturers always say, we want another generation of scientists doing the next thing in whatever subject.
No. I mean, you know, chemistry is one science, and all the sciences blur into each other. And it's, you know, when you go on with sciences, I mean, you find that if I'm in the chemistry department, for instance, we have mathematicians there, we have physicists there, we have biologists there. All the scientists are all sort of the boundaries are all blurred. But yes, I mean, you know, I say that there is still something to chemistry. It's, you know, how molecules interact and combine and rearrange and form new things. That's what chemistry is. But it is central to all sciences, but all sciences sort of blur into one anyway.
So what can the people who came to watch your recordings expect if they were to get into careers in chemistry? I mean, there were so many kids in the audience, and they're probably all wowed by the whole thing. If they're going to go off and do something with it, and they do their chemistry degree or whatever else, what can they expect to do with it?
But there are all sorts of different avenues that they can pursue. There's, you know, research into pharmaceuticals, obviously, but there's also materials, new materials science. I mean, so that's now called a completely different subject. I mean, material science, but I mean, it has its heart in chemistry, really. But, you know, you can still move towards physics. But actually, I think one of the most exciting areas is understanding the biology that occurs in our cells, in our bodies, at the molecular level. And there's, you know, so much research now and Nobel Prizes being awarded for understanding how biological processes happen, but with, you know, all the atoms mapped out, the structure of the protein known, how it folds up and how it's actually working. I mean, I still think that's chemistry, but it's very, very complicated chemistry, and that now has its own name. It's biochemistry, molecular biology and so on, but it's still the same sort of science, really.
We discussed some of this actually in the coverage of the Nobel Prizes. The Nobel Prize for Chemistry was given to two medics, actually, looking at the particular protein on many of our cells that allows things to go in and out of the cells. I remember speaking to the head of the Royal Society of Chemistry about, you know, the fact that chemistry seems to be going into biology. And he said, well, actually, biology, and there was a bloggers and other chemists who were saying that actually biology at its cutting edge is chemistry, and chemistry at its cutting edge is biology.
It's absolutely
what you were saying earlier,
yes,
about the combination, yeah, between the three. You need to understand how these molecules react with each other to actually get further in biology, and that, in fact, gets you further in chemistry too.
But different scientists do bring slightly different perspectives. Mm. I mean, so the chemist's view of biological processes would be, oh, you know, what's this atom doing here? How's that helping this thing to bind? And that's a slightly different perspective, but both perspectives are needed. And so, you know, that's one of the wonderful things about science, is this collaboration between the different sort of, you know, classical divisions of science.
Now, I'm going to wind up this interview by asking you a very difficult question, which I think you might have some difficulty answering, given that your love for chemistry in general. But it's of the zeitgeist, given the RI has got its advent calendar of mm-hmm. elements going on. What's your favourite element?
What is my favourite element? Well,
you can only have one.
I, well, okay.
And why?
It's a bit of a harsh question, I must say, because it's like, you know, trying to choose your favourite child or something. But so I have a lot of, you know, there are different
moments. Don't worry, they're not listening. The elements aren't listening.
So I might have said cesium at some point. I might have said oxygen at some point, or hydrogen possibly. But I think recently I've become very attached to xenon. I think it's
tell us what
it's
xenon
amazing.
Is and what's so interesting about it.
So xenon is one of the noble gases. Now, people would be most familiar with helium, which is the lightest gas. Xenon is in the same family. It has many similar properties, but it's the heaviest stable noble gas. And so for a long time, it was thought that none of this family interacted with any other elements. So, I mean, one thing that's remarkable about them is that they go around as single atoms. And this is one of the few times that we ever encounter single atoms, because of course normally they're bound up either, you know, in pairs, such as in oxygen gas O2 or nitrogen N2, or much larger molecules or structures. But the noble gases go around by themselves, which is pretty cool. But xenon is just amazing, because it's right at the bottom of the group. It's larger, and this means that it's sort of slightly easier to distort, and it's possible to remove electrons from this, which means in the 1960s scientist Neil Bartlett managed to prepare the first compound of xenon, which is pretty amazing because it's thought to be completely inert. But now, even more remarkable though, it has physiological effects on the body. So if you breathe in xenon, these atoms actually interact with your physiology, and it acts as an anesthetic. And this has all sorts of medical applications. It's a really, really powerful, very good anesthetic. It's only a little bit expensive. But even better than that, if that wasn't enough already, you can also use it in imaging. So I'm going to Sheffield to have my lungs imaged. So this is with Jim Wilde and his group there. They're going to use a particular isotope of xenon, and that's going to look at the space in my lungs, which I think is, you know, absolutely incredible. This is using an MRI scanner. So usually MRI scanners are looking at sort of the water content or hydrogen atoms in our bodies, so either in fats or water. But this is looking at xenon atoms in my lungs, which I think is pretty amazing.
That's a well-made case. And also, you didn't even mention the fact that it's got an X at the beginning. So that's another brilliant thing about xenon.
Well, watch the lectures and you'll see a very, very special guest who has xenon as a middle name.
So, yep. OK, Peter, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thanks there to Peter Wuthers. His lectures will be broadcast on BBC 4 on December the 26th, 27th and 28th. They'll be on iPlayer shortly after that for 7 days, but if you missed them there, you'll be able to see them on the Royal Institution's online channel by going to their website, www.rigb.org. That's it for this week. Thank you very much for listening. I'm Alok Jha, and Science Weekly is produced by Jason Phipps. Next week, we'll be rounding up the year looking at the biggest science stories of 2012. Till then, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.